Welcome to the Chamber of Musical Curiosities, a podcast exploring the world in and around Musica Viva Australia.
Hello, I'm Paul Kilday. Welcome to the Chamber of Musical Curiosities, a podcast exploring the world in and around Musica Viva Australia. I'm here today with the writer, broadcaster and commentator Jane Caro. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you very much for having me.
When kicking around names for this podcast, the thing that came most vividly to my mind was those Wunderkammern, popular in the 16th and 17th century, a room of cabinet full of exotic objects, antlers, claws, stuffed birds, artworks plundered from many different lands, a skeleton playing the violin.
I reckon that's I'm one a stuffed bird.
Which I think is a pretty neat way of describing a chamber music concert, a chamber of marvels. But in the real sense, the same concept could be applied to your career. How do you chart it in retrospect, the linear path of it?
It doesn't really have a linear path. Well, I think if there's one thing that holds it all together, and that is my one and only talent, which is a knack with words and an ability to use them, I think, to connect with other people. And that I've always considered to be my only real talent. And I've honed it, I suppose, over time, as one does when you concentrate on one thing. But when I first started out, I left school in 1974. I did a straight English literature degree, no education or anything. And even in those days, that was really unusual. And I had no idea what I was going to do when I finished my degree. I still had the old-fashioned view, which I still hold, that education for its own sake is of value. I know very unpopular, but particularly under the Philistine government we currently suffer under. But that was my view then, it is my view now, and I actually followed it through. It's turned out to be immensely useful. And the only opportunities I got were to go into marketing, and so that's what I did. And that was really pure nepotism. That was my father was in marketing and well-known, so our last name isn't Smith. So people heard Caro and thought, oh, I wonder if that is Andrew Caro's daughter. Oh, he's got a big advertising budget. Maybe she'd be worth hiring. It was shameless, nothing to do with my talent, certainly nothing to do with my marks, which were pretty ordinary. I majored in having a bloody good time. So it started from there. It started because I took the opportunities that were in front of me. I didn't kind of plan anything. I was absolutely shithouse at marketing. It involves being able to add up quite a great deal more than I ever realised it would. And that wasn't useful to me and I wasn't useful to them. But by a circuitous route, I found my way, mostly again to do with my father's position and reputation, into the creative departments of advertising agencies. And I found that there I was actually good. I had a way of thinking and a way of looking at things that worked for that. So that's when I started. And it was literally, that was the opportunity. I took it. I searched until I found the bit of it that suited me better. That was being creative rather than administrative, and I still can't organise my way out of a paper bag. And I started from there, and I really did enjoy it. I enjoyed it enormously, and I learnt things in advertising that I'm still discovering I learnt. Do you know what I mean? Like, you do things in a job and you don't necessarily know that you've learnt them from that job or that other people don't know them. You sort of often assume that the knowledge you have, everyone has, and then you find out, oh, no, actually, that's because of that. And I worked in advertising on and off. I mean, I got fired when I was 4 months pregnant. We're talking about the 80s. Feminism was not as powerful then as it is now, though I always identified as a feminist and out loud, proud, irritatingly, I'm sure, to the men who employed me. But stuff that, that's what a feminism is. It's meant to irritate powerful men. It's its job. So I got fired when I was 4 months pregnant and wondered if I'd ever get back in. And I'd done a thing on the side where I trained as a group leader and I worked with Relationships Australia and did a counselling course while I was had a small baby and all that kind of thing, and thought I might go into that area. But trying to practice with two small children, a husband who travelled all the time, I couldn't do it. So I again thought I've wasted my time. But actually, the things I learnt as a telephone counsellor first, then as a group leader, and then eventually in counselling, even though I never practised, have been so immensely useful. And particularly when it comes to interviewing people, doing the documentaries I do, that ability to listen to what's being said under the words and connect with the emotion that is being often obliquely communicated has been valuable beyond anything. Again, I didn't plan it. It was just something I was interested in.
I think I was going to ask you about that. Well, I mean, as a slightly bookish child, if you're going to then go and take up English literature as your degree, were you more interested in the words, the beauty of language, or the message?
The message. Always the message. Always the story. I've had to accept that I'm not a poet. I'm a communicator. And yes, as a child, I actually taught, and I wasn't just a bit of a bookish child, I was an obsessively bookish child. I would constantly be reading, but I taught myself to skim read. I taught myself to speed read, really, but it was a form of skim reading, which was, and I still do it to this day, I don't read the is the, you know, those kinds of words. I don't read the sentence like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I pluck the main words out. I just do this unconsciously and fill the rest in. And I taught myself to do that as a child. So that was a form of impatience. There is a part of my nature. I'm very energetic. I'm a very, you know, fast-moving person. No, not physically, actually. I'm quite slow when I walk. But in my approach to life, I want to do things quickly and get them done and do them now. And I think the downside of that energy is impatience. So sometimes I get impatient with poetry for its own sake.
I'm just wondering if being a bookish child is in the 60s and 70s is slightly a reflection of there being so little to do in Australia at that time. and I'm just wondering if music managed to creep its way into your life at the same time.
It didn't really until I was a teenager. And the reason for that is that my father is completely deaf in one ear. And so music is not something that he has ever, I mean, he likes music, but he's not all that interested in it. I think deafness has that effect for obvious reasons. So we didn't even have a record player at home until I was a teenager, really. And I don't remember hearing much music in my home. The radio was always tuned to talk. We were an intellectual, verbal family. My parents read all the time. So music didn't play a huge part until, I mean, I was lucky enough to, my neighbour across the road was quite interested in music and I can remember she had good popular taste. So the song she played over and over, and this is my best friend's mother, who would have been, I suppose, in her late 30s, early 40s at that time, was Sunny. She used to play that, Sunny, oh so true, I love you. You know, that kind of music she would play all the time. And I still have an absolute love of that kind of good 60s popular music. And then, of course, I went to a very musical school. Forest High was, like a lot of public schools in Australia, very big on the brass band. I never played an instrument. I went to Chatswood Public into the OC class and we were all meant to play the flute, and I have always been contrary, and if you try to make me do something, I'm very unlikely to do it.
Yes, the young girls were meant to play the flute. That's,
yes.
That's
oh,
what
we
they
all
did.
Had to. We all had to, this little piccolo thing, and I never learned a note, just refused to. They let me in the band in the end, the flute band, because I was the only kid in the class who wasn't in it, and the music master just said to me, you can go and sit in it, move your fingers, just don't blow.
I've heard that story with some people in choirs. It was very common in choirs where the music master would come and just tap the person and just say, just mouth, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah.
But I've never heard that with a flute player.
Yeah, that was me. Well, I wasn't a flute player. That was the point. But it meant that my peers had a real interest in music. And, of course, I was a 12, 13, 14-year-old in the era of the most fantastic rock and roll, you know, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Led Zeppelin, the Beatles were just coming to an end. But the richness of that particular era of music and the passion with which my friends particularly absorbed it affected me. I spent my teenage years at Forest High going to rock concerts with my mates, and I saw the most extraordinary array of people. I was at that Led Zeppelin concert in Sydney, which is now the focus of photographic exhibitions and things. It was in, I think it was in 1972, and it was the only concert they played here. And I still remember it, first concert I'd ever been to in my life, apart from the Monkees, which was hilarious when I was 11, and where we just screamed, we didn't hear the music. And I went to see people like Muddy Waters and John Mayall and Santana and Ossa Bissa and Brian Ferry and Jethro Tull, the most extraordinary array of bands at the Horden Pavilion. And my schoolmates would organise it because they were so passionate about music, and I'd just go along because they were my friends. But, of course, I got exposed to it and came to love it.
We had a live stream concert from San Francisco by the pianist Gary Colson, and he talked about the tour that he did earlier this year in Australia and how overwhelmed he was by the concentration and passion of the audiences. And almost what you're describing there, Jane, is that experience that you had, and a very formative experience as part of an audience, and the kind of the chemistry that comes and that reaction between the musicians on stage and those in the audience. What do you think of when you talk about that kind of chemical reaction?
I think it's always exciting to see any performance in the flesh, be it a Shakespeare play or a concert. There's something much more engaging and involving about being there. And I would always get up and dance. I do love to dance. Still, this embarrasses my children enormously, but I still love to dance. I get a physical reaction to the music. I want to move with it. I want to sing along with it. I want to participate in it. And I think one of the great things about rock music, in a way, is that audiences don't have to be silent. You know, you can get up and dance at the Horden in those days. You could run down the aisle to the front in front of the stage and all dance. It wasn't a mosh pit. It was a dance floor. You know, that's what you did. And you could sing along at the top of your voice because it was so loud. No one would ever be able to hear. You weren't interrupting them. And so I think I like that ability to participate. I have, of course, been to many classical music concerts and very much enjoyed them. But I find what I love about that, I feel less of a participant there. Often what I find I love about that is my mind drifts and goes into all sorts of places and imaginings and thoughts and ideas while I'm listening to the music. It's somehow freeing to have your ears occupied with something lovely. It allows your mind, it's a bit, and you're going to hate this because it sounds so prosaic, but I'm sorry, I am a bit prosaic by nature. It's a bit like doing a very good gym class or dance routine where your body is occupied so your mind is free, or even doing the housework. I sometimes have my best ideas doing some housework because my mind is free to wander while my body or my ears is doing something else.
I don't find that too prosaic at all. Not least of all because I do think sometimes music, and at least hearing music or participating as an audience member, is a form of almost spiritual meditative practice. So I love where my mind goes. And in fact, it's slightly different from the dance class and also being in a live rock concert, pop concert, because you are so still and you are so quiet, mm-hmm. and therefore all that you have in terms of escape is the chamber of the mind.
Yes, and I do find that. And it is a form of concentration, even though it feels like your mind's wandering. But I don't mind that. I think if my mind wants to wander to places that is inspired by the music I'm hearing, good. Who knows what I'll find there.
Music Aviva would like to say thanks for the support and ongoing partnership of Wesfarmers Arts. Wesfarmers Arts understand the vital contribution that the arts make to the communities in which we live and work, bringing people and art together.
Speaking of what you'll find, I'd be really interested to hear a little bit about your experiences working with Gonski. Education seems to be such an important part of the way that you think, and your conviction that it's at the core of a civilized and advanced society. And you've kind of put your money where your mouth is on this one. And so I'd love to hear about that experience.
Unfortunately, because I'm an absolute aficionado of public schools, I haven't put much money there, which has been a great boon for my kids. Went to public schools and I've done fine. All you people wasting hundreds of thousands on buying status and prestige, stop it immediately. You don't need to do it. It's a con. I feel very strongly. I think my passion about education comes out of my passion for social justice and my fundamental belief that every child in a civilized society should have as equal as possible an opportunity to develop their potential regardless of who their parents are. I do not like the idea of inherited anything. Now, it's unavoidable. I got my break because my father was somebody and therefore my name. It is inevitable. I understand that. But an education system ought to work to narrow that inevitability, to actually narrow the gap between those who are members of the lucky sperm club, like I was, and those who are not. But we uniquely in Australia use our education system to drive those inequalities, to widen those gaps, to ensure that the privileged stay privileged and the disadvantaged stay disadvantaged from childhood. And that, to me, is deeply offensive. And it was John Howard's education policy that really got me active, because it was so blatant, the giving of extraordinary amounts of public money to schools that were exclusive by nature and privileged by nature, just struck me as so profoundly anti-democratic that I had to get active, and so I did. And I've been active in this space for at least 20 years now. And whilst we have not won in the way that we would like to, the Gonski reforms have been thoroughly warped and undermined, unfortunately, first by Malcolm Turnbull's government and even more egregiously by Scott Morrison, who hands out gifts to private schools for no discernible reason and gives absolutely nothing to public schools, even during COVID and everything else, which is disgraceful. But what we have managed to do, and I'm a very small part of this, there are an awful lot of people who are working in this space, is change the rhetoric. When I first got active, the whole thing, the sort of driver of education, bizarrely, was claimed to be parental choice. You know, it was terribly important to give parents choice. Well, we never actually gave parents choice. We gave some schools choice over which kids they would or would not educate. We didn't give parents any choice. We gave schools, some schools, public and private, choice over which kids they would allow to come to them or not, and that's disgraceful. But we have changed that rhetoric. We don't hear parental choice talked about much anymore. We do hear about needs-based. And the fundamental thing about Gonski was that it was meant to be a needs-based, sector-blind scheme, and then they decided to legislate that the federal government would give 80% of the SRS to private schools and 20% to public, and the states were supposed to, and then it became a sector-based needs-blind funding scheme yet again. So we're still fighting.
It's interesting, that whole thing of shifting rhetoric, because it is so immensely powerful. And I'm just wondering if, tracing your history as a feminist thinker and activist, how the rhetoric has changed in that time, and how much for the good, and how much do you think that you've either stood still or stepped back?
Oh, I think feminism is dynamic and exciting and energetic and vigorous. I've never minded that feminists fight with each other, that they disagree with each other, that they have very strong contrary views, because that, to my mind, is the sign of a dynamic and vigorous and still engaged movement. You know, feminism's not a cult. It's a revolutionary movement, and therefore people have strong views about it. That's fine. And I do think that what's happening now is incredibly exciting and incredibly scary. And those two things are inevitably going to go together, because we always knew that the more successful feminism was, the more we managed to make the argument that women are entitled to be taken seriously, to develop their potential, to live the kind of life they choose to live rather than the one they're told to live, the more successful we got at making that argument and actually achieving those things, the harder some people would fight back. And that's called the backlash. And what we're seeing at the moment is, post-Me Too, I think, this terrible backlash, particularly on, and I'm quite blunt about saying this, religiously driven. It is about patriarchal religion wanting to push women, LGBTQI people, anyone they see as different, not a white straight male really, back under white straight male control. That's what those religions were designed for, and that is what they are fighting very hard to maintain. I mean, if you think about what's happened recently, certainly in Australia and in a lot of the West, equal marriage is now legal all over the, you know, so many places around the world that you would never have thought so. Even Ireland, who beat us to it, which is incredible. Abortion was decriminalised finally in New South Wales last year. Now there are lots of pushes going on, and it's certainly legal in Victoria And I think there's moves afoot to have it happen in WA, which will happen soon, which is voluntary assisted dying. What that means is the church is losing control of birth, death, and marriage. What the hell else did they have? So that I put to feminism. I also put to feminism the growing awareness, horror, and action about systemic child sex abuse in religious institutions, but across the board, really. And that when you give women more voice, more power, more agency, you inevitably give children more voice, more power, more agency, because generally women are the caretakers of children. When you diminish women and you diminish children and you silence them, you make the world safer for those who would do them harm and riskier for those who are at risk. And that's why the speaking up is so powerful and why it's so confronting. The language doesn't bother me so much. It can get a bit academic, a bit not the kind of language I trade in. I try to be a straight, clear speaker. But things, concepts like intersectionality, very powerful and important to recognise the levels of discrimination that, I mean, I'm a straight white woman from a privileged background. The discrimination I've experienced is minor in comparison to if someone is a person of colour, an Indigenous woman, a woman with a disability, you know, a woman who comes from a very poor, underprivileged background, all those things. But I am experiencing another intersectionality now, the one that's not quite so recognised sometimes, and that is age and the real weight of age discrimination, particularly against women in our society, is only just starting to be looked at now.
You wrote a book with just a wonderful title that I think speaks to a very large phenomenon, which is accidental feminists. And it's this idea just from that, that women wouldn't identify as a feminist, but then find out in the course of their lives and their careers and all the rest of it, that of course that they have to be, you know, to stand up. But I still find it astonishing that you will have female political figures who say, well, I don't identify as a feminist. Is that basically what was behind you writing that book?
No, I wanted to draw attention. The title came after the book, really. I can't remember the previous titles. But no, what I wanted to do in that book was draw attention to the fate of my generation of women. And what made it happen was that I had a bit of an epiphany one afternoon, hanging washing on the line, as I do, and I suddenly thought, my God, my generation is revolutionary. We're the first generation of women ever in the history of the world. Ever in the history of the world, who have mostly earned their own money for most of their lives. This has never happened before. But no one's noticed. We're not talking about it. We're not saying, look at this amazing generation and this change, you know, wow. And I thought, but I am part of that generation. I've noticed. I'll have to write about this. And I was feeling rather smug. I was thinking, aren't we clever? Aren't we a fabulous generation? And then I heard that terrible statistic, which is that the fastest growing group amongst the homeless is women over 55. And I went, hang on, well, how can those two things both be true?
That doesn't correlate at all, yeah.
And so that's what sent me on the journey of investigating the fate of my generation. And what I found, tragically, was that it wasn't the bolshy, outspoken feminists like me who did decide to go out and get careers when we left school and university in the mid to late 70s and did all of that, who were the ones who were ending up poor. It was the good girls. It was the girls I went to school with who said, oh, no, I just want to get married and settle down. They're the ones. They've been left high and dry. They've been used and abused. It's appalling. The stats are horrifying. 34% of single women, that's women who are never married, divorced or widowed, so it's a lot of women by the time they're 60, 34% of them live in poverty. By the time they are pension age, by the time they are 67 and above, that's 50% of them are living in poverty. And is there an outcry? Is there outrage? Do we have people in Parliament slamming tables saying we need to do something about it? No. These are women no one wants to f***. Couldn't they just go off and die? Yeah. If they can't do that, well, live out of your car, darling. Who cares about you? It is outrageous. That's what makes women feminists, let me tell you. The women politicians who say, and it's usually politicians some business leaders, a lot of the business leaders I notice stay very quiet until they leave the corporate scene, and then they start saying, oh, yes, I believe in quotas. Oh, yes, I believe in, you know, then they speak up. And they do it because, and I'm not going to condemn them for it, they do it for the same reason that women have always done things like that. They do it because to survive in the male-dominated environments in which they find themselves, they have to. Right-wing women I find always very sad. I feel very sorry for them because a lot of them have what I call Nancy Reagan eyes. Nancy Reagan always had that look. It may have been the plastic surgery, I don't know, but she always had that look. And that look is, am I doing okay? Am I doing okay? Is it all right? Am I approved of? Am I thin enough? Am I sweet enough? Am I nice enough? Do the guys still like me? Is it okay? Is it okay? Is it okay? It's like a lifetime seeking of male approval. And that's exhausting. And the problem is it's a zero-sum game. You'll never get it. You'll never get it. They keep withholding it and withholding it and withholding it and withholding it because that's how they keep the power. And the sad thing is they get a little bit, they get ahead, they get, you know, they get to be the tame girl who proves that feminists are wrong, you know, blah, 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 until they get to a certain age or a certain stage. And then the guys go,
yeah.
And the trouble for those poor women is they've alienated the only people who would have stood by them, which is other women. And the men were never really their friend. It's really. So I don't blame them. They're doing what they need to do to get what it is that they want. They are working within a system which puts them in an impossible situation.
Mm. I think I know the answer to this, but do you find it helpful to have enemies, or do you go out of your way to cultivate enemies, or do they just line up because you're saying things that are so confrontational to them?
I don't have any enemies myself. People may think I'm their enemy, but that's in their head. This is not personal. I mean, I can get irritated and annoyed, and there are particular public figures who have said or done or routinely demonstrate attitudes that I find obnoxious and actually harmful. And certainly I may hate the idea of them, or I may hate the ideas that they propound. I try very hard not to hate any person. I can even find it in my heart, as long as I'm not actually seeing or listening to his voice, to have some pity for Donald Trump, because I do see a tragically isolated, lonely, pathetic human being within that. He reminds me always of the Wizard of Oz, you know, who had all those projections and big noises and machines, and then the curtain blows up and reveals that he's just a rather silly little man.
Pull back the curtain.
And when he's not in front of me and he's not, I can, and I'm not hearing that awful voice, I can find it in my heart to have some human empathy for the person he could have been and was for all sorts of reasons. I don't believe that any baby is born evil or wicked. I don't believe in evil. I really don't. But I think we damage people along the way, and they can therefore then do terrible damage themselves. So I don't feel like I have any enemies. I know there are a lot of people who hate me, but I think they hate the idea of me. They don't know me. Hmm. So it's not me they hate. It's some construct they've created. And that's how I manage not to let it worry me, because I think, well, you don't know me, so why does it matter what you think of me? I certainly have enemies that are ideas, yes.
Yeah. You left England at a very young age. Do you have any pull at all to that as either a memory or a construct in that way that Tony Abbott seems to be so drawn back to a country of mystical power?
Yes, interesting, isn't it? I think Julia Gillard, Tony Abbott and I arrived more or less the same time. Quite kind of interesting. They've had much rockier roads, I think, than I have. Yeah, I am in some ways, I will culturally always be English, in the same way I think that Greek Australians often are culturally always Greek, and Italian Australians always Italian, and I'm sure Sudanese Australians as well, because it's in the marrow of my bones, which I was brought up with. I did English literature at university. I still find myself drawn much more to English culture than I am to American culture. I like English humour more. I like English literature. And I'm very interested in English history. I've written historical novels about Queen Elizabeth I. So I'm very engaged from that perspective. But I think I'm engaged in an England that doesn't exist anymore, that is probably the England of my parents' childhood. So, yes, I'm not drawn particularly to the England or the Great Britain of today, but, yes, its past I find endlessly fascinating, and I think I have to accept that Englishness is part of who I am.
And that would be the distinction, actually, between you and Tony Abbott, that you recognise that it's a mirage of England, if you like, whereas he still feels as though that place exists and wants to be, you know, part of it. It's a funny thing to watch.
Well, he's a man, and I think people don't understand that women are always outsiders. Men are insiders. And the old Britain of my parents' childhood was very male-centric, and Tony Abbott probably could have had a place there. But I couldn't, and my mother didn't. And my mother felt very strong. She loved Australia from the minute she landed here as a mother of three at 33, I suppose she was, young mother, because she grew up in Manchester in Lancashire, and she has a Lancashire accent. And my father was a bit Manchester too, but posh Manchester, went to Manchester Grammar School and Cambridge University, so he's got a non-regional accent. And my mother said that the reason she loved Australia was that for the first time in her life when she came here, nobody listened to her speak and judged her class and thought she was common. They just thought she was English. And that was so liberating to her. That made such a difference to how she felt about this place. And I think that had a huge effect, particularly on her daughters.
Jane, I feel grateful and privileged that you do have a role in Australian society. Please keep up the fight. It's been a delight talking to you today.
Thank you very much, and right back at you, Paul.
Thank you for listening. You can find show notes for the episode on our website, musicaviva.com.au/podcast. To learn more about our work and upcoming concerts, find us on Facebook by searching Music Aviva Australia and on Instagram and Twitter with the handle @MusicAvivaAU. Thanks again, and see you next time.